Good afternoon. I also would like to thank Heiko, Lyra, and Pia for hosting us, hosting me at this very interesting conference, event, etc. It's been fantastic. I particularly enjoyed last night, but I've enjoyed all the talks as well, so thank you. What I'm about to say derives from a much longer piece, and I ought to attribute my co-author, Tanya Applin, professor at King's College London, who I'm co-writing this with, and it's a piece generally on the quotation right in law. And what you're going to get from me is builds on, differs slightly from the sorts of things that Eberhard has been saying, but is founded in questions of interpretation of legal texts that might apply to the Neumeier decision. So let me start with the relevant legal texts. So the starting point is Article 5, Paragraph 3 of the Information Society Directive. This is an EU directive, so an EU harmonized law that limits what member states can do in relation to copyright. And it requires member states to recognize certain particular rights for the authors of musical works and also for the producers of phonograms. And those rights are identified in Articles 2 and 3 of the directive. And Article 2 is the right to reproduce the work in whole or in part, directly or indirectly. And that right is given in relation to musical works and in relation to sound recordings. And we had some discussion yesterday. Martin Kretschmer, in his very interesting presentation, talked about how that notion of copying, a very broad notion that covered uses in whole or in part, had emerged and how that diverged from the 18th and early 19th century notions of printing and reprinting works. Article 3 of the directive confers on these same characters, authors of musical works, inter alia, and producers of phonograms, the right to communicate the work to the public or make it available. So under European law, all member states have to give these reproduction and communication rights to authors and producers of phonograms. Now, Article 5, Paragraph 3 then contains a whole list of derogations or exceptions to those rights that are permissible for member states to have. And Article 5.3d says that member states may provide for exceptions or limitations in relation to quotations for purposes such as criticism or review, provided that they relate to a work or other subject matter, such as a phonogram, which has already been lawfully made available to the public. Unless this turns out to be impossible, the source, including the author's name, is indicated, so there must be attribution. The work must have been made available to the public. And then there are two key substantive requirements, that the use is in accordance with fair practice and is the extent of the use is that required by the specific purpose. So you have a capacity for member states to have exceptions that allow quotations for purposes such as criticism or review, as long as they meet these four criteria. The work, phonogram, has been made available, there's attribution, the use is in accordance with fair practice, and it's to the extent required by the specific purpose. Now, what I want to suggest, first of all, is that although this provision says may, member states may provide for exceptions, so it seems to confer a freedom on member states, then in fact there's an obligation on member states to permit quotations. So the first move I'm going to make, in a sort of parody of philosophers who say you can't make an ought from an is, is I'm going to try and make a must from a may. So let me do this by using a standard legal technique, which is to say, how are we going to interpret this provision? Are there other provisions that can help our understanding of it? And there is indeed another provision in an international convention called the Berne Convention. And the Berne Convention applies to 176 nations around the world and is the international convention that says what rights those states must recognize for authors and also says some things about limitations on those rights. And Article 10 of the Berne Convention is a remarkable provision because it requires countries to provide a quotation exception. So Article 10.1 says it shall be permissible to make quotations from a work which has already been lawfully made available to the public, provided that their making is compatible with fair use and their extent does not exceed that justified by the purpose. Article 10.3 then conditions, which I haven't put on the slide, then conditions this on the attribution of the authorship. So you find within this provision, Article 10 of the Berne Convention, the four qualifications of the freedom to provide the quotation right that you saw in European law, that the work must have been available, that there must be attribution, that the use must be in accordance with fair practice and must be to the extent required for the specific purpose. But unlike the European provision, it's couched not as a permission to member states, it's couched as an obligation. And because of this, because European law is nested within international law, all member states of the European are parties to the Berne Convention, it would be the case that the Court of Justice of the European Union would interpret Article 5.3d in the light of those international obligations. So my first move then is to make a must from the may, and I do that in that way. Now I'm going to go on and talk a little bit more about Article 10.1, because Article 10.1, it seems to me, does something very dramatic and something that's not really been appreciated until recently. Properly understood, I say that Article 10.1 of the Berne Convention in fact requires parties to the Berne Convention to provide for something that is equivalent to fair use in the United States. So that properly understood, we have a globally applicable convention to 176 countries that requires, mandates, fair use. Article 10.1 is, in my view, global mandatory fair use. So, how do I get here? Well, the first point, first key step, is that the quotation that has to be exempt from the copyright owner's rights under Article 10 is not limited by purpose. Okay, so it includes artistic and expressive purposes. Now contrast the Information Society Directive that talks about quotations for purposes such as criticism or review. Some people would read that as saying the only quotations that fall within the exception are those for criticism or review or things like criticism or review. Now look at Article 10. It shall be permissible to make quotations, full stop. No mention of purposes. It shall be permissible to make quotations. The law could not be more clear in the Berne Convention. So my first move is to say the quotations that must be made by member states to Articles 2 and 3 of the directive are quotations irrespective of the purpose of the quotation. Now, if you think that's a bit ambitious, if you actually go back and look at the texts leading to the Berne Convention Article 10, so these were conferences held at an international level in the 1960s, you will find that the suggestion was raised on a number of occasions to limit the quotation right by purpose. And that suggestion was rejected on a number of occasions, confirming our view, the obvious view, that the literal reading is there is an obligation to permit quotation, whatever the purpose of the quotation. So that's the first key step. Now, then I have two further steps in this argument. The first is that the Berne Convention covers a broad array of cultural fields. And therefore, the concept of quotation that it obliges member states to introduce, that concept of quotation must be one that is applicable to all cultural fields. In particular, it should not be understood as one that is equated with a print or text-based notion of quotation. Secondly, what I want to try and show is that if we look at examples, a bit like the way Eberhard did just a moment ago, we can see when we look broadly across the cultural sphere that the notion of quotation is very broad and very different from that text-based quotation. So it ends up, in fact, merely as saying that uses, Article 10 ends up merely as saying that uses that are in accordance with fair practice and proportionate and attributed in relation to works that are made available must be permitted by members of the Berne Union. So this is what a text-based view of quotation might look like. If we think about the paradigm, and I think Eberhard alluded to this, of a quotation in an academic book or article, we would have a reproduction of a short passage taken from a much longer text, where the passage is presented as unaltered, or where there's alterations, there are dot, dot, dots, or little squares, square brackets to indicate. And where the passage is presented as distinct, usually set in another text, the quoting text, which is usually longer and which deploys the quoted text in its own argument, whether to support the use the quote to support the argument or whether the text contradicts the quote. And that would be a classic print or text-based conception. And what I'm arguing is that, in fact, Article 10 can't have that in mind. And it can't have that in mind because the Berne Convention is a convention that applies to musical works, artistic works, dramatic works, and film works. And that print-based conception would make no sense in those other cultural environments. So then when we move to those other cultural environments, the question is, what does quotation mean? And I just am going to give one example, which is art usage. And I want to give an example that may well be very familiar to you, and to say, to ask the question, how do art historians think of this particular use? Do they think of it as quotation or not? And if they think of it as quotation, then what does that imply for the legal meaning of quotation? And the example is Manet's Le Déjeuner Célèbre, very, very famous picture. You will all be familiar with it. It's kind of regarded as a central moment in the development of modernism in painting. It involves rather beautiful and amazing application of paint. At the same time, it is an extremely odd and confronting image of two Parisian men, one bearded, having a picnic with a naked woman, as you do in the suburbs of Paris, while in the background there is a woman who's cleaning her feet, and she's sort of in the background, but maybe she's half in the foreground as well. She sort of occupies a very strange position. So this very famous picture from 1862 is well known as being based on indirectly on a Raphael drawing via an engraving by Raimondi. And at the top left of your screen, you can see the whole of the Raimondi engraving of the Raphael drawing. And in the bottom right, you can see an excerpt taken from the bottom right of the Raimondi engraving. And if you look at that and then compare it with the Manet picture, you can see immediately the various aspects of the disposition of the characters have been derived clearly from the Raimondi engraving. Of course, the three characters are no longer water gods and a river nymph. They're Parisians and a naked woman. They are Parisian men and a naked woman. Their attitudes are slightly different, etc., and obviously their meaning has been changed. So the question I want to ask is this the sort of thing that an art historian would call a quotation? And the answer is, if you go to the art history books, yes. So I looked at the commentaries on Le Déjeuner, and Michael Fried, one of the leading commentators, says, Le Déjeuner is perhaps the most notorious instance of quotation from the old masters in Manet's oeuvre. Fried explains that three foregrounded figures in Manet's painting are a direct quotation from Raimondi's engraving. But he's not alone, so I have two other sources, Beatrice Farwell and Carol Armstrong, each of which also talk about this in terms of quotation. Beatrice Farwell asks, why did Manet need Raphael? And explains that in using Raphael, he was invoking an ideal, referencing the past, etc. It is this and not weakness of imagination that lay behind Manet's quotations of the old masters. And in fact, Manet is very well known as having participated in these kind of practices in relation to a large number of old masters, Titian, Watteau, Velázquez, and so forth. So what do we get from that? A cultural rather than a textual conception of quotation is not limited by these characteristics of a short excerpt taken from a longer piece, presented as distinct and used in direct comedy, commentary or explication. Rather, the notion of quotation as used in art, and I think in culture more generally, includes imitations and transformations as well as replication. No requirement of distinctness, that's just incorporated within Manet's work, and need not have any explicit kind of commentary on the work. So then the question arises, well, is that true of sampling? And yes, commentators on sampling have equally described sampling in terms of quotation. And I have some examples there on the slides. Mark Katz talking about sampling as performative quotation, and Kevin Home Hudson as timbral quotation. People like to try and create subcategories of quotation, but there is, I think, quite broad use within the sphere of the term quotation. Now, I'm going to just conclude there. I was going to add in a little more complexity. I think there's probably enough complexity already here for most of you on a Sunday afternoon. But the conclusion would be that the reuse of musical sound will always be a form of quotation. And whether there is infringement depends just on these other requirements, whether the use is in accordance with fair practice, whether it's proportionate to the purpose of the user, and whether there's attribution. And with that, I will leave you for questions.